or something there. It's kind of interesting. So Ali really has a love for industrial sales, and has a great deal of business knowledge and accomplishments. She's a 2018 alumnus of the Small Business Administration Emerging Leaders, and 2019 alumnus of Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses recognition. And again, she named her company 3G after her three children. So I think that's an interesting connection here. Next to Aaliyah is Jason Wilson. Many of you know Jason. He's a graduate of Auburn University in supply chain, and did a little stint in that official area for a while before starting in 2009 in Gadsden Back 40 Beer. And I've got a quick spill on those beers here, so we don't have any problems with microphone. He built Back 40 from the ground up. Company is has distribution centers over seven states, and his latest endeavor, he started a new microbrewery, Coldwater Mountain Brew in Anniston in 2022. Includes a restaurant, features a large outdoor space for guests, and that's adjacent to the Coldwater Mountain bike trail. So welcome, Jason. Thanks for coming back as well. And last but certainly not least, we are glad to have Boyd Stevens with us. For over two decades, he's been an entrepreneur. Over the last 12 years or so, he's the founder, and this is his title. I did not come up with this. Chief Data Nerd at Netellius. He really has a passion, and over a period of about 5.5 years, really started doing a good bit of mentoring and leading other entrepreneurs, which all kind of culminated in 2019 in the Montgomery area with the launch of the I-85 Cider Corridor Initiative. It's the purpose of that is to help create and sustain the system services infrastructure and relationships necessary for a robust, creative tech startup community in the river region. So we talked a little bit, obviously, in the last session about ecosystems, and you have an opportunity to actually hear from someone that's actually building that. So with that, I'm going to encourage each of them as they answer some of the questions. I'm sure they're going to weave their story and how they got started and challenges and those types of things. So we'll start off again. Be thinking of questions, and I'll open it up shortly for you guys. But to each of you, just so, and whoever wants to jump in first, please go ahead. You know, just as an entrepreneur, really getting started, later growing your business, what have been some of your greatest challenges and obstacles through that process?
I'll start. I don't need a microphone, but I said that one time at the Inc. 5000 list of fastest growing companies in America ceremony, and Jim Koch, the founder of Boston Beer, said, "Hey, jerk, it's not about you. They're recording the audio, talking to the microphone." I was like, "Okay, I'll talk into the mic." Look, the biggest thing for me, I started Back 40 when I was 27 years old. I was just young enough and dumb enough to have no idea what I was trying to accomplish. We essentially hadn't had a manufacturing brewery in Alabama since Prohibition. I mean, so we were going on almost 90 years, 87 years since we had had a proper manufacturing brewery. But I was 27 years old. I didn't know what I was getting into. And it was, looking back, it was exponentially more challenging because I didn't have local resources to call on really back then. I didn't really have any of the support system that I was looking for my local community. I mean, you got to imagine, this was 2008, in the middle of the worst economic collapse, essentially since the Great Depression, with the housing collapse. And I was walking into banks as a first-time entrepreneur wanting to start the first manufacturing brewery in Alabama since Prohibition in the middle of the worst economic environment since the Great Depression. As you can imagine, those conversations were pretty short, you know. So I had to pivot, you know. I had to figure something out, but I didn't have anybody on the municipal or the local or the economic development level to turn to at that time. Yes, there were some figureheads in some certain really early elementary roles back then of what economic development looked like in a community. But that was my biggest challenge, is I had to just figure it out. I mean, but again, it was also my biggest opportunity or my biggest asset, was I was too young and naive to know how daunting the task was that I was setting out on But it would have been exponentially more valuable if I would have had people in my community that could just tell me, hey, you're going to have to get a business license. You know, here's the number you call to do that. Hey, you're going to need an accountant. Here's a list of 10 local CPAs that you can work with. Hey, you're going to need a lawyer. Trust me, you're going to need a lawyer. You know, here's some registered certified lawyers that have experience in that field or something. So all of those things would have been exponentially more helpful for me. But really, that was my biggest challenge, was just resources. I just didn't even know who to ask. I didn't know what I didn't know.
So Jason, just following up along those lines before Aaliyah and Morty jump in, just what made you decide to leave the corporate world, what you're doing in supply chain, take the opportunity, the challenge? What obstacles did you have kind of just making that jump?
Well, a lot of it was about my personality, you know. I mean, I was late getting here today. Number one, don't ever trust an entrepreneur when he tells you he's on the way. Number two, the law enforcement officers in Dayville are unreasonable, in my opinion. We'll follow up with that next month. I'm sorry, what was the question?
How did you feel from the corporate world deciding to do this?
Well, that was a lot of it. You know, in the words of the great Jerry Garcia, I'm going where the climate suits my clothes. You know, I'd come to Auburn as just this simple kid from Gadsden, Alabama, that was going to be the first person in my family to graduate from college. And I walk into the Sigma Nu house, you know, as a pledge, and I'm surrounded by 57 of my pledge brothers, and they're all second-generation college graduates. You know, they were all doctor's kids, lawyer's kids, or somebody else that had broken through that barrier, and now they were the second generation of this. So I looked around and said, man, I got some catching up to do. You know, if I even want to get on pace with my peers as a college kid, I've got to work twice as hard as everybody else, which means I got to swing for the fences. You know, I got to figure out a home run swing. I can't just go get a degree and be a lawyer, because I'll still be a generation behind all these other second generation lawyer kids. And so entrepreneurship's the only way. That's the only way to do it. I gotta hit a home run swing. And then I looked around and said, hey, I can drink beer as good as any of these other doctor's kids and lawyer's kids. And so I started home brewing, and it was just something that turned into a passion for me. And nobody else was doing it. And my brother was living in Crested Butte, Colorado at the time. He was a ski instructor, so like any good college bum, I would go out there on Christmas break and crash on his couch for free and eat all his food and ski for free, you know, and get the heck out of there. But there were a couple of craft breweries out there. And I was like, man, why is nobody doing this in Alabama? Why? We have such a strong passion for supporting local businesses. So much of our story is told at the dinner table with food and beverage. You know, so much of our history is about food and drink. Like, why has nobody connected the dots here and made this thing an industry in Alabama? And so, again, that circled back around to me being too young and naive to realize what I was setting out to try to do. But, you know, that was really what inspired me, was, okay, I'm going to do something that no one else is doing. So
that's a great point. I didn't mention during the presentation, but you know, entrepreneurship's a great equalizer. You know, it doesn't really matter on your background necessarily. It's a passion and opportunity.
Well, it's great. That's a great point. And I'm sorry, I don't need to already start dominating this thing. But, you know, I've been working on this project that's about to come to fruition in the next 6 months, hopefully, about it's a nonprofit concept called the Cool Club. And it's a social club, it's a social atmosphere where we have dinners and receptions and fine cocktails and everything. But it's connecting opportunities with outstanding leadership, okay? And essentially, it's an investment club, okay? But it's in a social setting. So there'll be multiple tiers of membership where you get access to some pitch ideas in the community. And my point in that, David, is the real opportunity that I see is as people who are involved in economic development in local communities, you got tons of great leaders in your community that don't even know what they want to do yet. They don't even have the idea yet. They don't have the widget yet. they have all the characteristics and the skill sets to be successful as an entrepreneur, but they may not necessarily have their thing yet. So what if we could bring cool ideas? Like we talk a lot, I'm a city councilman in Gadsden, we talk a lot about C-Click-Fix, the app that has been so transformative for small communities where citizens can take a picture and say, hey, this drain's backed up, and it goes straight to the city and they can route it through. It's incredible as far as efficiency goes. But what if you could engage that on an entrepreneurial level? What if somebody could drive by and take a picture of an old abandoned building and say, man, this would be a really cool taco joint. And now that project gets posted. Okay, well, put your money where your mouth is. What if we have a local entrepreneur that is excited to pursue a venture but doesn't necessarily know what their future venture is, and they go, hey, I want to own this project. I want to own this project at this abandoned building. And then they have built-in support around them from people in the community. So,
Leah Boyd, same question back. What are the greatest challenges or obstacles?
Boy, we're not following it. You'll take it.
No. I can't believe that was actually the original question. I'm so sorry.
So my journey, a little bit different from Jason, and then...
Talking to the microphone,
because they're recording, right?
They're recording.
So a little different, a little similar in the sense that I was almost an accidental entrepreneur. I went through a life-changing, you know, event. I got a divorce. I tell people I dropped 250 pounds, and they're like, wow! And I'm like, yeah, but I kept his last name. He doesn't like when I say that either. It'll be okay. But you know, I still had to take care
of my kids. I just want to say I love my wife.
I still had to take care of my kids. I had three kids, three small kids at the time, and I had to figure it out. I'm a speech therapist by trade. I did that for about 6 years, and I realized this is not going to work for me. I mean, I love kids, but I was literally raising other people's kids and then going home and not having time for my own. So I figured, okay, I'm going through a divorce, I've got three kids, why not start a business? That sounds right. So I stepped out there. Let's back it up. I was working also as a sales rep right before I went through my divorce, and in that moment when I decided I wanted to be an entrepreneur, my boss had flew into town. She knew I was going through a divorce. She sat right across from me and she said, do you realize I can take every account that you have right now? I was like, well, wait a minute. I've been doing this for you for I don't know how long. Every account, they know me. I mean, if that's the way you want to play this, then game on. So, you know, I stayed there for another year. I researched, I talked to my customers, I called manufacturers, and I said, hey, you know, if I decide to go out on my own, would you come with me? And all my customers said, what took you so long? I was like, well, dang. You know, because I wasn't thinking that entrepreneurship was for me. I was thinking, I need to take care of my kids and I have responsibilities. But in that moment, that was the light bulb moment, that my customers liked me, they wanted to work with me, and they were encouraging me to go forward. Now, in saying all of that, the challenges were what Jason said, I just didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't realize that I needed accounting and I needed that lawyer back. And that I needed, you know, all of these things. So I was learning as I was going. And it was extremely challenging. It was frustrating. You know, now I'm having to not only sell the product, I'm having to ship the product, I'm having to sometimes deliver the product, I'm having to now go back and invoice, I'm having to be the collections agency. It was a lot. It was a lot, but that is all a part of that entrepreneurial journey. And as much as I love it, I wish I had the community that Jason is talking about. I wish I had the person that I could have called and said, hey, this is what I want to do. How can you help me get this started? How can you help me build this building block? And I didn't know about this, you know, community of economic development. And I had to go about 5 years, and I'm only in my eighth year. I had to go almost 5 years before I really realized this is what I need. I need to be picking every brain and talking to every person that I possibly can so that I can get as much information as I can.
And that's so important, just an exclamation point on that. Like, I know private equity groups right now that manage billions of dollars that I talk to regularly about different entrepreneurial ideas. They will not invest in an entrepreneur unless he's failed, he or she has failed two or three times. You know, when you talk about not knowing what you don't know, there are huge tranches of money out there that won't even talk to you unless you've failed a couple of times, unless you've done it wrong a couple of times. Mm-hmm. So the biggest problem that we have as entrepreneurs communicating with local municipalities and leaders and economic development agencies and all the people that are represented in this room, you are taught your whole life to avoid failure at all costs. From the day you're a kid, don't fail that test, don't fail that quiz, don't fail, don't fail, don't fail. And it's the worst advice you've ever gotten in your life. Because you have to fail to be successful. You have to fail to become an expert. The only way you become good at what you do is to fail. And so what we talk about a lot, and David imparted this in me, you know, a decade ago or more when I first started being a part of this, is learn how to fail fast and fail cheap. The goal is not to avoid failure.
That's right.
The goal is to create a system in which failure can exist.
That's right.
But you identify it quickly.
That's right.
And move on from it. The
That's
goal
right.
is not to avoid failure. And as long as you are approaching your local economic environment with the goal of avoid failure, it's doomed to fail from the get-go.
Right.
If you create and allow for failure, but you surround people with the tools they need to be successful, mm-hmm. they'll get good really quick. You know, it's like I interview with the culinary school. I've been on the advisory board at the culinary school here at Auburn for years, and we always do these mock interviews with the kids, and they'll all come in and they're super nervous, you know, and just like shaking. And I said, wait a minute, listen, what if I told you that on your seventh job interview, you would get your dream job? You would get the job you had always wanted. What would you do? And they all say the same thing. I would line up the first six interviews as fast as I can, you know, and stumble through them. Exactly. That's what's happening. Those first six interviews that you go through, you're learning how to be a good candidate. You're learning how to interview. You're learning what employers actually value, what they're looking for in an employee, and you're learning how to promote the best parts of yourself. So by the time you get to job seven, that's why you get the job. It is because you went through those first six failures. So just go through them as fast as you can.
So I would say my greatest challenge was just ignorance, right? Piggybacking on this, I did everything my parents told me to do. I went to school, got good grades, I was a merit scholar, all of that stuff. And I was seriously ignorant about capitalism. But my daddy, I used to ask him some things and he didn't know how to articulate it, because I wanted to know, why did all the folk who graduated magna cum laude dealing with bankruptcies, and the folk who couldn't half say their names had all the money in the bank? And I used to ask him that, because he and my mother were just drilling in me. Go to school, get good grades, get a good job. And I've been nosy all my life, and I'm looking around. I'm like, Pop, Mr. Smith, he can't half talk. But they call him Mr. when he goes into the bank. He's the guy with all the land. He's the guy with all the cattle. I grew up in a farming community. He's the guy that people go to when they want to get something done. Explain that to me. So then I come to this illustrious university across the street, and I meet fellow freshmen who are driving Mercedes. And I go, that's your mama's car? No, they bought me this for graduation. And I'm taking calculus with them and physics with them, and I'm smoking them in class, but they know something I don't know. I know what that is now. We send young people to school for almost two decades, and we never teach them how money works. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Never. And we allow them to run up one of two forms of debt that a bankruptcy won't erase.
That's right.
It's amazing. Now, if you're a conspiracy theorist, as some say I am, you say that's by design. But we're not going to go there today. We want to keep it nice and light. But I'm having to unlearn this stuff. Failure. Man, ever since I was knee-high to a grasshopper, if you missed the exam, missed the question on the exam, the red ink came out. If you just failure. And so I entered this thing called business. And I remember talking to someone that says, hey, I need to know all the things I need to do so I don't mess up. And one of my first business mentors, he's like, son, that's not going to happen. That's a part of the process. You just need to learn how to minimize the casualties, right? Minimize the damage. That's on the business side. On the community building side, the biggest challenges have been around the human condition. And that's fear again. When people are afraid, they do the most illogical things. And the folk that we normally deal with as a entrepreneur who looked across our landscape, and that's everything from Montgomery to Auburn, Opelika, and seeing just the plethora of tech opportunities and bringing people in on our dime entrepreneurially from Austin, Texas, saying, hey, what do you think? And they're like, dude, nobody's ever done this? Nah. And then you reach out to your regional economic development folk, your regional chamber people. And that's when the fear starts to exhibit itself, where people are afraid that you're going to show them up. People are afraid that you're going to do something that makes them look bad. You're going to do something that makes them feel like, or maybe their senior or direct reports feel like you're doing their job. And you're like, no, we're in this together. But again, fear. Fear makes people do seriously illogical things. I'll stop on this point. Whenever I hear people say, it doesn't matter who gets the credit, I know I'm talking to someone who's never built community. Because giving credit is your currency. And what happens is those who traditionally do economic development sometimes will take credit for what folk in the community do. And they don't realize they are acting as saboteurs to the community building. But I know what's driving that. I tell our leadership, I said, look at us as your black ops. Think militarily. I said, look at us, we entrepreneurs, think of us as your black ops. I said, I get it. A mayor's office can't fail, because that junk's coming back up in 3 years, all right? Chambers can't fail. I get it. Let your entrepreneurs be your black ops. All we do is fail, okay?
Really good at it.
We're really good at it. We are very comfortable with being called out, and if you're a good entrepreneur, you're very comfortable with the three-word sentence. I don't know. It's my fault. I messed up. You were right. I am wrong. See, nobody else is comfortable with that. We say it like it's like we drink water. And so use us as your black ops. If we go out and do it and fail, you can go, I don't know what those crazy entrepreneurs are doing.
Yeah.
But if we're successful, then you come around and allow us to love on you. Because we don't mind you being, because most of us don't want to be in front of the camera. We're too busy trying to worry about what's in the bank. So you come do the photo op, do the camera, be on the news brief. We don't want to talk with the reporter. We will whisper in your ear what to tell them so you don't lie. But it's again, it's just working together and collaborating. That's been the challenge on the economic development side, building community.
Really good stuff. So let me just open it up right now. I don't know if there's something that they've already said that has spurred a question in your mind or a direction you want to go. Anybody have anything at this point they want to ask?
I have a question. Thinking that when you guys started out, how important or how helpful, and this I'm being totally selfish asking this question, by the way, this ain't for y'all. How helpful would it have been for you guys as a entrepreneur to be able to have access to extremely affordable, high quality retail space that was located in or near an office park that allowed you to have walkable patrons?
Look, there's no doubt in my mind, and I can speak to this as an entrepreneur and as an elected official. There's no doubt in my mind that co-working space and small working spaces are valuable in a community. But one of the things we were talking about at the Entrepreneurship Summit at the National League of Cities a few months ago was that's not enough.
Exactly.
It's not enough. Like, can you give me a co-working space that also offers affordable childcare? Can you give me a co-working space that also, I don't just need to have access to broadband internet. I don't need to just have access to a desk. You have to start really digging in as a community and talking about what are the real barriers to entry for entrepreneurs. And a lot of times it's things like lack of access to childcare. You know, you've got a mother at home that has some great idea, or a father, whoever the stay-at-home parent is, that has a great idea. But no matter how much they work through that concept, no matter how much they see that opportunity, this giant barrier exists at the end, which is who's going to watch my kids? And sometimes it's that simple. You know, I work a lot with homelessness in our community, and we talk a lot about that. You know, there's all these different defined reasons that people end up without housing. You know what it turns out? In about 68% of those situations, it's primarily caused by lack of identification. When you get kicked out of your house, when you get evicted out of an apartment, what do? The landlord takes all your stuff and throws it on the curb. Well, there goes your birth certificate. There goes your driver's license. There goes your Social Security card. You know, so now you may have access to medical resources. You may have access to state and federal resources that can help you get back on your feet, but you don't have an ID. So now you got to go through the process. You may not be able to stay on your medication if it's a mental health situation, because you can't register for the state or federal program to get your medication because you don't have an ID. So sometimes it's as simple as this one little thing. What if I can get you a copy of your birth certificate? If I can get you your birth certificate, you can get your Social Security card. If you can get your Social Security card, you can get your driver's license. If you can get your driver's license, you can get registered for the state and federal programs. If you can get registered for those programs, you can get the resources you need to stabilize yourself and get back in the community. Same thing is true with entrepreneurship. Sometimes it's as simple as this one little thing, like, I don't know who's going to watch my kid. So my challenge to you, to answer your question, maybe somewhat long-winded, is think about what really keeps people from pursuing their dreams in my community or pursuing that opportunity. And the truth is, it's much more practical than you think it is. It's not some giant multi-million dollar answer. It's, yeah, I can pick your kids up if you can drop them off, you know.
And to add to that, I think a side of that also is when you're looking at having this space, like Jason said, what comes along with that? So childcare, but what about other resources? Like, you're putting me in this space, but now if I'm still not educated on how to manage my resources, how to manage my finances, how to budget, how to do QuickBooks, then I'm here and I still don't know how to build revenue. So are there gonna be other resources tied to that? Are you gonna have us in a space where there's an attorney attached to it? There is a financial advisor attached to it. So now you get those resources right under that one roof. And now we can utilize that to help us grow. So it has to be something other than just an address. Because we can work from home.
100%, you know? And just to pile on that, the only successful incubator models that I've ever seen, and a lot of these revolving loan funds, there's a laundry list of the ones that have failed, and there's a laundry list of poorly thought out incubator models that have failed. The only successful ones that I've seen have a core of affordable or free space for those to foster that entrepreneurial spirit in your community, but it is surrounded by market rate rented spots. You know, your accountants, your attorneys, your insurance companies. These are all people that know they have a front row seat to the future of the businesses in their community, and they're willing to pay full market rent to be in that space and be right down right down the hallway, you know, a knock on the door from some of these startups. So to Aaliyah's point, it's a great model. It's not enough to create a co-working space. You have to surround them with resources.
I would also answer that coming from the perspective of someone who for the last 10 years have trained 500 plus entrepreneurs. All right. And this is through 13 weeks of extensive how do you discover and how do you develop customers. The challenge with an entrepreneur, if you give an entrepreneur with no customers money, they're just going to find innovative ways to spend it. Right? What they need more than a co-working space, what they need more than you know, access, is they need customers. The most valuable thing that the folk in this room could bring to the entrepreneurial ecosystem are your relationships. Introducing people who possibly have problems that are painful enough that as an entrepreneur, I can offer a solution to solve that problem. So now that goes two ways, right? So we entrepreneurs love showing up, talking about we want access. But oftentimes when we get in the room, we're not prepped, right? We're not prepped. We don't understand that business is farming. It's not hunting. It's about building relationships. People do business with people they feel comfortable doing business with. So the space is great, but if I don't have any customers, all I'm gonna do all day is go sit in the space, right? And you know, we tell our entrepreneurs that's the problem. You need to get your rump out of the building, go talk to some folk, right? Talk to some people and try to understand what problems are they suffering from that you may be able to bring a solution to the table. So that's the other side of that though is if you want to look at some physical asset, what physical asset could an economic development professional bring to the table, right? Because we normally want to think about buildings, we want to think about property, we want to think about space. Those things are good. But I think it's the combination or the amalgamation of all of that through a service. All right, so what do I mean? Well, when I'm starting out as an entrepreneur, especially if you are as ignorant as I was, I'm terrified, right? I don't know anything. I don't know anybody. My head was down as a network admin for the largest mortgage company in the Southeast. I went to work, did my job, went home, hung out with a few folk, knew my people at church, but I didn't know any bankers. I knew I needed an attorney to keep from going to federal prison. I had no idea the importance of insurance. I didn't know the difference between an accountant and a banker, right? And huge thing, I didn't realize I actually, as brilliant as I thought I was, I didn't realize I really needed a mentor. And that relationship was a two-way street, right? So how can you take that physical asset and then use it and leverage it? How can we take high-speed internet? How can we take Class A office space? All of this stuff, and then make it a service through which these relationships are fostered, right? And I don't want to come to another networking event. Because most times when they're held, we forget the root of the word. We should call it net, let's get something to eat. Net, let's get our liquor drinking on, all right? Net, let's, you know, go hang out in the corner. Rarely do we go to those events and actually work. We tell our entrepreneurs, when you go to an event like that, when you go to a conference, when you go to a chain, you should be exhausted when you come out of there because you've worked. Well, I don't know that. And a lot of times when I go to these events, the chamber people are all huddled in one corner when it's their event. Nobody's introducing me. And most entrepreneurs will allow that to happen once. I say, man, I ain't going to that stuff anymore. Man, those people are sitting up there, they're bougie. They won't introduce me to anybody. They're not talking to anybody. What are they getting paid for? So again, leverage those assets through a service that could introduce me to foster those relationships. I think that would really be helpful.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Yes.
All right, so this is really for all three of y'all. When y'all got started, strategic plan that you can really go by and say, like, okay, this is how I'm gonna do it. So step one, step two, step three. Everybody has their own story. But CapEx, we have a lot of, you know, people that are aspiring entrepreneurs, such as myself. A lot of people don't have the money. They don't have the resources to get out there and really do what they envision to be an entrepreneur. What, you don't have to go in depth, go in detail. Like,
oh, it's too late, buddy.
Yeah. No,
so, finish the question.
Yeah. You're not an entrepreneur. You don't have to look at that. So, like, what did you do? I mean, especially you around that time. I mean, that's really crazy to me. But somehow it worked. Like, what were you able to do to be able to get that money or get that funding to kind of help you get going?
All right, give me this thing.
I'm giving it to you.
No, I'm kidding. No, I really do relate a lot to this question, man, because again, I was the first person in my family to ever even go to college. You know, my first house had a dirt floor kitchen. My second house was given to me by the pastor of our church, my family, okay? So I always love this quote by Tony Robbins. The most successful people in the world started out with nothing. If you go back and look, so historically speaking, over a long arc, almost everybody that became wildly successful came from a place of extreme poverty. So this idea that you have to have resources to be successful is a fallacy, that you have to disabuse yourself of as fast as you can, okay? You don't have to have resources to be successful. You have to be resourceful.
That's right.
You have to know where
That's
to
right.
go and get what you're
That's
lacking
right.
and how to do it. And
That's
there's
right.
a difference in having resources and being resourceful.
That's right.
And so I'll tell you a quick story, and it might not be that quick, but for David's sake, I'll try to make it as quick as I can. When I was 27 years old, I was sitting in a corporate office on the 43rd floor of the Georgia Pacific building in downtown Atlanta doing supply chain optimization, which was what I graduated from college to do. And I had had this intense passion to open a brewery for probably 2 years, man. And I'd just been incessantly reading about as much as I could about the brewing industry. And at the time, to put it in perspective, when I started Back 40 Beer Company, there were 248 breweries in America. Today there's 9,000, okay? And I just kept telling myself, I think there's something here that everybody else is missing, and I couldn't shake it. But I knew I didn't have money. I knew I didn't have the resources to go build a multi-million dollar brewery. I mean, we're $37 million into our facility in Gadsden now. I certainly, as a 27-year-old kid who crammed 4 years of college into six, certainly didn't have any money to speak of. And so I just started trying to figure it out. And I read this book by Jim Koch, the founder of Boston Beer Company, Sam Adams, the old guy you see on the commercials, smelling the hops, first billionaire of craft beer. And I read his biography, and he told the story about when he graduated college, his granddad was a brewer for, I think it was Yingling, or maybe it was Schlitz, way back in the day. And he had uncovered one of his grandfather's old lager recipes, homebrew recipes, and he wanted to make it and put it back out on the market. And he said, but I didn't have any money, and I didn't know what to do. And so I started calling all these local manufacturers around me. And I found this one beverage company out in Philadelphia that was also brewing beer for Schlitz. I think it's a rollover. You know, they were just a backup in case the brewery went down, they would step in and fill the orders. And he said, so I went to him and said, hey, if I brought a recipe to you guys, would y'all manufacture it for me? And they said, yeah. And they quoted him a price per case and said, we'll do it for $10 a case. And he said, so then all I had to do was go out and sell it. I just went and knocked door to door to sell as much beer as I could. And then eventually, after about 3 years, I'd proven my model and I was able to go to a local bank and get some money to build my own brewery. And then eventually I built another one, and then I expanded. And I eventually became the largest craft brewery in America. And I said, that's what I gotta do. This is the answer. And so me, being the young, naive entrepreneur that I was, I picked up the phone and I called Jim Koch's office. And his secretary answered, and I said, I'd like to speak to Jim Koch. And she said, that's not exactly how it works. And I said, well, can I leave my name and number and ask him to call me back? And she said, yeah, sure. And so I did. And every week I would call his office. And it took about 6 or 7 weeks. And I got to be real good friends with Miss Teresa. And she said, I promise if given the opportunity, I will give him your information. And one day I was on my lunch break in Atlanta and I was walking down Peachtree Street and my phone rang and it was Jim Koch. And I said, Mr. Koch, thank you so much for calling me back. I have so many questions. And I told him my whole story. And he said, well, Jason, you don't need a brewery to start a brewery.
That's right.
Let me tell you how to do it. Mm-hmm. And he shared every single thing. So to Boyd's point about mentorship.
That's right.
I cannot like that comment enough. I got in touch with somebody who knew how to do it. And I didn't have to make the same mistakes that he made. And he showed me a path. And when I hung up the phone, I said, that's what I'm gonna do. I got it. And I started calling any brewery within 500 miles of Gadsden, Alabama. And I finally got in touch with Lazy Magnolia Brewery in Kiln, Mississippi, down around Biloxi, home of Brett Favre. But they had just gone through Katrina. And it wiped their brewery out. They were a really young, small startup craft brewery. And it wiped it out. But they got this huge EIDL loan from the SBA. And so they were able to build back this beautiful Taj Mahal of a brewery with all this money they got from the disaster loan fund. And so they had all this extra capacity. And I said, hey, if I buy my labels and my six-pack carriers, anything that had my brand on it, I said, would y'all let me come down there on the weekends and make beer while y'all
aren't
there?
That's right.
And they said, sure, we got all these extra tanks.
That's right.
You know, we need to fill them up. You know, we got to pay the bills.
That's right.
And so I would leave my office on Friday afternoon in Atlanta and drive all night and get to Kiln, Mississippi late Friday night, early Saturday morning. I'd wake up, I'd brew beer all Saturday and Sunday. And it took my CapEx, to your point, from what I thought was about $3 million.
That's right.
To $24,000.
That's right.
And I raised $24,000 to buy my first set of labels and six packs because they had agreed to give me 30-day terms. Mm. And they already had all the raw materials. Mm. They had the bottles, they had the generic caps, they had all the grain and the barley and the hops that I used in my recipes. And so all I had to buy was a roll of bottle labels and a box of six pack carriers. And I was in business. And I went to Birmingham Budweiser, and this was my one coup d'etat I will give myself credit for. I didn't know it at the time. Lazy Magnolia had agreed to give me 30-day terms on the invoices. They would ship my beer, and I didn't have to pay them for 30 days. Well, I went to Birmingham Budweiser and negotiated 14-day payment.
That's right.
So on the day that
truck right.
delivered.
That's right.
So I never had to, I was floating, I was playing with the house's money.
That's
the,
right.
My manufacturer right. was giving me 30-day terms.
That's right.
And I had 14-day payment terms with my customers. So
that's
I
right.
was getting paid before I ever owed them.
That's right.
And so I just, that's what started it. And I did that for 18 months until I was finally able to approach a local bank and say, look, here's what we did.
That's
we
right.
proved our model. We proved our brand. Now give us the money we need to do it ourselves.
This is lean startup in the whole Bible.
No, it's right on.
But Boyd, and Lee, if you want to answer that question.
So you're talking timing, right?
Yes.
I left my really, really good job 1 month after 9/11 happened. My manager and my VP spent 30 minutes trying to scare me into staying. My mom, that Christmas, that was in October, that Christmas, I normally, because that job was with a financial institution and I almost had a month off a year. That Christmas, while we're washing Christmas dinner dishes, I look at my mother and I said, hey, you know I'm gonna have to leave tomorrow to get back into the business. And my mom looked at me and says, nobody told you to leave that good job. All right. What's my point? My point is the reason that my VP and my manager didn't scare me is before I left, I already had customers. So when I hear people talk about wanting to be an entrepreneur, I say, so what are you doing in your free time? So if you're sitting up watching the Super Bowl, but you want to start a business, I question, do you really want to start a business? Are you constantly, you know, just hanging out, but you really want to start? No, I'm questioning that, right? Because what happens, I would meet customers at 5 in the morning, work until 7:30. Well, I was going to leave the job one January 1st. I didn't. I was afraid. And I realized the only way I'm going to do this is I've got to get over the fear. And so I had an epiphany. What if I run both businesses full time? I don't cheat my employer, but I run this business really full time. What would that be like? And so I would meet customers at 5 o'clock in the morning. I never lied. I said, hey, I'm working full time, but I'm doing part time, I'm keeping things separate. I'd work till 7:30, I'd go to my job at 8, I would, on my lunch hour, I would work the business, and then from 5 o'clock in the afternoon till 9, 10 o'clock at night, I'd work the business. Wow. 3 months of that, fear was gone. I said, shoot, I can do this. And so while I'm sitting there having this 1 month after 9/11, because, you know, things were a little shaky, I was like, I got this. Spun off the next company 3 months after the housing bubble burst. Mm-hmm. Now, by this time, I figured it out. Can I go ahead and say it? Recessions are what the powers that be tell the common folk. Mm-hmm. What really happened in 2007, 8, 9, it was the R word. It was a redistribution of wealth. Mm-hmm. Because you got banks that were too big for folk to know the present. But they were the primary culprits in the whole deal. So what really went on? Well, when you understand capitalism, you understand that during the Great Depression, some folk came off smoking like a bandit. Because it's a redistribution of wealth. And so you don't look at what's, you don't listen to NBC and ABC and CBS News like everyone else. Because that's the hype machine, right? They're tapping into the fears and the trepidations of the masses. You begin to look around and go, they're not burning the money. They're not digging a hole and putting it in. Where did it go? Oh, it got redistributed. So how can I put myself in a posture for some of that redistribution? There's always problems. So the having capital, I would, if you were in one of our training sessions, I'd lean back into you and go, for why? You have any customers? Because it's really, really neat, resourcefulness, right? It's really neat how if you do that thing right, you'll have folk ready to swipe their credit card before you have to incur debt.
That's it.
And that's where the resourcefulness comes from on the entrepreneurial side of the house.
Well, and it's very rarely what's keeping you from starting your business is very rarely lack of access to capital. Don't get me wrong, it's going to be a real problem that haunts you throughout your entrepreneurial life is access to capital, but that's almost never the reason you didn't start.
That's right.
It's usually just you may have chosen that, like, you know, again, Tony Robbins talks a lot about every leader's, if you ask somebody why are you not where you want to be in life, they'll say, well, I didn't have the money. I didn't have the time. I didn't have the right people. And it's funny because the people say the reason they're not successful is because they didn't have the right leader. And the leaders say the reason they're not successful is because they didn't have the right people. Those are all excuses. You know, Edward Deming said, I blame zero defects on the operator. He was the godfather of continuous improvement in the manufacturing world, okay? He said, I blame zero defects on the operator because if something failed, it's because you have not put a system in place in which failure couldn't occur. That will take a lifetime to achieve. Our goal is to be godlike. We know it's unattainable, but it doesn't change the fact that that's our goal. You know, if you're 99.9% efficient, you can always be 99.95% efficient. And so my thing is, as an entrepreneur, if you're looking at capital and going, oh, well, my problem is I don't have access to capital. What I would tell you is good ideas never have to worry about access to capital. Develop your idea, put it in, and figure out ways to bootstrap it, figure out ways to get it started. Again, to Boyd's point, there's one point in my life, I was 27 years old, I was working in Atlanta, making beer in Mississippi and selling it in Alabama. When you get there, then tell me that capital is what's stopping you. Because I'm telling you, if you'll focus on just get it on the shelf. I tell entrepreneurs, especially in the food and beverage space, this all the time, and consumer products. This is America. We will buy anything. You can paint a rock bright yellow and put it on the shelf at Walmart and move 10,000 units. Okay? It's never lack of sales.
That's right.
Okay? It's you looking for an excuse not to do. As an entrepreneur, taking the leap from a full-time job to the complete black hole that is the unknown and uncertainty of entrepreneurship, it's really hard. And there's nothing I can do to eliminate that huge leap. But there are a lot of things you can do to shrink the gap. For example, bootstrap your business. Get a product out there at the local convenience store. You know, if you make the best chocolate chip cookie in town, do what you see on the shelf every day when you walk into the gas station. Wrap those things with cellophane and print out an Avery label.
That's right.
And go put it on the shelf.
That's
Get
right.
Get your product on the shelf.
That's
and
right.
I promise you the rest of it will figure itself out. You just got to do it.
All right. Lee, you want to talk about your source answer?
Well, I mean, kudos to everything they say because they're absolutely 100% correct on that. But to Jason's point as well, you just got to do it, right? You can't worry about whether or not, because if you go to what Boyd said about making sure you have customers, if you heard me, that's what I said. I started interviewing my customers when I was with the other company, saying, hey, if I leave, that didn't guarantee that that's what they were gonna do, right? You know, they could have just been blowing smoke and like, okay, let me get this girl out of here. But they really did. As a matter of fact, one of my customers, I was so fearful of doing it. One of my customers called me and said, I need to place an order, Aaliyah, but I'm not gonna do it unless you're doing it under your company. And
that's
I was
right.
Like, holy shit. I mean, you. In that moment, but my customer pushed me out there and said, you got this. I am your biggest supporter. I am so, yes, absolutely. Have those conversations. Do market research. Make sure that, you know, whatever it is, if you can negotiate your terms. Now, I didn't learn that till later. I was bootstrapping.
Right.
and that's the real thing. You know, that 30-day and your manufacturer or your vendor is saying, I need my money. Well, I do too. So we're in the same boat. So if you can negotiate terms ahead of time, if you can, you know, if you can get family investors, I know you're saying that, you know, having resources, but if you can get other people to say, I believe in you, this is the part. Now that's a little bit more pressure because now you got to perform not only for yourself, but for these people you got to pay back, right? And then mentors, exactly. So I had, when I first started out, I had about 3 mentors. I had one in finance, I had, sort of a lawyer, but not really, we're not gonna go into that. But you know, so you need, I think for me, you need multiple mentors in different aspects of it so that they can, you know, you can pull together all of that information and then kind of decide, how am I gonna approach this? So strategy is, I think, everything. If you can build it, and it's gonna change, but if you can build it out initially, you have a playbook. You have something to kind of go by. And I love the fact that what was the book you said you read with the gentleman?
Oh, Jim Koch, biography, yeah.
Read, find books that are in line with whatever it is you're trying to do, you know, because that knowledge is free. Can't take that from you, so.
And if I may, the other thing, so I'm big on the 3 feet rule, and that is everything you need to be successful in life, God has put 3 feet within your grasp. Historically, we can't see it. So when I was at that corporate job in the IT department, there was a company that managed the records for the mortgage company. And for some reason, when I got hired on the IT department in this group, there was just always contention. I mean, they just contention. Well, one of the first projects I took on was I redeveloped the printing system for 7 states. And this guy had these big green band printers that he wanted to put on the network. And so word came to me, he needed some help. Well, IT's like, you know, don't go down and help him. I'm like, you know, why not? I've automated the printing. I don't have anything else to do. Well, you just shouldn't help him. I said, well, maybe, you know, we need to treat people like people, right? Just simple stuff you learn in kindergarten, right? Treat people nicely. So I go down, I put the printers on the network, and he looks at me and he's like, you know, you didn't have to do that. I said, yes, sir. He said, how much do I owe you? Nothing. I said, I had to be here till 5 anyway. I needed something to do, and I walked off. Well, he heard I was leaving. He sent word to me, you tell him when he leaves, make sure he comes to see me. I left, went to see him for probably the first 3 years of the business. He was our largest customer. He had about 50, 60 employees. He had no IT department. And we were handling everything he did. Oh, did I didn't tell you, he's one of my first business mentors. That cat poured into me. All right. But it's simple stuff, like the resources you need are there. Oftentimes, you just can't see them. Or we don't think much of them. Right? You know, who's he or who's she? Well, that's the banker's first cousin. Go treat him nice. Might put a word in for you. You know, it's amazing. A little simple stuff like that.
I mean, a lot of times it seems out of reach too. This is just last anecdotal thing, but I had this kid just a couple of weeks ago, goes to my local high school. His parents eat at our restaurants and stuff. And they said, would you be willing to talk to our son? He's really infatuated with entrepreneurship. He's a junior in high school, blah, blah, blah. And so I said, yeah, sure, man, I'll talk to him. And so we met, that's another reason I think Jeremy won't hire me at GEDI, is because I drink beer at lunch. But anyway, so I had a beer with his family and him, and we were just kind of talking about what ambitions were. And he said, I'm really big into custom automobiles, like doing these high-end super customs, like what I would call as a kid of the 80s, you know, the pimp my ride days. But now it goes way beyond that. I mean, these cars are millions and millions of dollars. I mean, it's a really high-end industry. And he said, I really love it. I love the idea of customizing and modifying vehicles. And I said, okay, well, what are you doing? What are you doing to pursue that as a junior in high school? And he said, well, I don't know. I mean, I like it. It's cool. I said, okay, do you watch a lot of YouTube videos? And he said, yeah. I said, is there somebody that you're a huge fan of? And he goes, oh, yeah, there's this one dude. I said, well, have you reached out to him? Have you sent him a message? Have you tried to contact him, send him an email? And he goes, oh, no, this guy's like 54 million followers. He's out of Japan. He's this worldwide celebrity in custom automobiles. And I said, so? Send him a message.
That's right.
Tell him you're into what he's doing, that you're really digging what he's doing, and tell him you're young and you're wanting to learn more about the industry and what steps he can take to put himself in the best position to be successful in that industry. And he was like, oh yes, sir. You know, all timid. And I'm not kidding, dude. 2 months later, his parents emailed me and said, you will never believe this, Jason. He emailed that guy in Japan, and the guy replied to him and said, you're not going to believe this. I'm flying into the United States, into New Orleans in 2 months in June to do this custom vehicle build out for some NBA basketball player in New Orleans. He said, would you be willing to come down and spend the week with me? You can work side by side with me in the shop on this build, and you'll be a part of our social media videos and everything. And so they planned their family vacation to take this kid down here so he can hang out with like his superhero from YouTube. Wow. And it's all because he just sent him a message, man. And that's the best advice you can give to local entrepreneurs, is connecting those dots.
That's right.
Hey, man, just call this guy, because here's the funny thing. People who are good at what they do love to talk about it.
Or
just get in front of them and ask them one question. David, did you even make it to question two?
No.
Or one question. So.
Or return a call.
Exactly.
Return the email.
Absolutely.
When people reach out to you, reach back out.
100%.
Don't let months go by. Well, did you call them? Nah.
It's key. Yeah.
Why not? It's a powerful thing. Powerful thing.
You can't script this. You just can't script.
Powerful thing.
Other questions quickly.
Boyd, can you repeat that 3 feet rule real quick?
It's everything you need to be successful in life. The Creator has put 3 feet within your grasp.
Okay.
We just typically, we're like the Church of Laodicea in Revelation 3. We can't see it. And so we go around pouting about what we don't have and the opportunity that's not there. And you're like, my blessing, when I was attending that university across the street, by my junior year, all of my close friends were from the West Indies. St. Lucia, St. Croix, Jamaica, Antigua. And hanging out with them, two things happened. I became the local interpreter, because when they talk to each other, their English speeds up and people didn't know what they were saying. But the second thing is, after about 6 months, I begin to see this country through their eyes. And that really took away the woulda, coulda, shoulda, the man's after me. No, this is a land, it's not happenstance. And don't get me wrong, this country is really jammed up. Got a lot of problems. But God dog, it ain't going nowhere. Not when everybody on the planet's trying to get here. There must be something going on here economically. And hanging out with those guys throughout my matriculation process, I began to see this country through their eyes, and that hadn't changed. And that's been coming up on 40 years.
All right, we got one question up here. We got about 5 minutes or so, approximately, so we have to have a little quicker response. But these are great. I wish we could go all afternoon on this. We got to go for more time next.
Yeah, I'm going to try to make this quick, but as a young professional, I was overhearing you guys talk about all these facing challenges, and it was always something that come up, so it kind of deterred you guys from doing whatever you wanted to do. So what do you feel like are some of the best habits that you would give me as an up-and-coming businesswoman that I should probably have in order to move forward to my company or a business? And which one do y'all feel like would be more important? Having like an innovation mindset,
I would say quit asking for permission, because you're never going to be given permission. The folk who you report to, especially if you're good at your job, they don't want you to leave, so they're not giving you permission. A lot of the fear that you deal with isn't your fears, the fear of the family and the folk that you love and respect. And I have the same conversation with women that I have with minorities. You say, oh, you know, what am I supposed to do? Quit asking for permission. Nobody's gonna give you permission. What's that, what's the quote from Frederick Douglass? Power cedes nothing without demand. It never has, it never will. So stop asking for permission and just go do you.
Right, I like that, boy. I would say, first of all, life is not going to be without challenges, right? So you have to bob and weave with those challenges. If that didn't work, you got to pick up and go. Some of y'all, the comedian, when he said, I just keep throwing things up against the wall, hoping that they'll stick, you know, just keep trying and trying stuff. That's basically what you're doing, right? But at the same time, don't let your compassion betray you. So don't let
That's right.
what your heart is telling you you should do betray you and have you thinking that, okay, I can't not do this. That may not be what's for you. It may be something else. So you have to constantly be reading, constantly be studying, constantly be talking to people, figuring out. And then to Boyd's point, you ain't gotta ask permission. We're in a day now where people are creating their own jobs. They're not looking on, you know, there are still people looking on Indeed, but people are saying, you know what, I think this is what I want to do, and they're going out and creating that lane for themselves. I had to build my own table, because nobody was asking Aaliyah to be an industrial chemical supplier. So I had to say, you know what, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to put this together, and this is me, and here it is. So, you know, continue to just research, continue to strategize. I use that word all the time. You just have to have a strategy in place, a plan in place, an idea in place. And so I know you said, what's more important? Is it to be, would you say, is it more?
Say that again? Or have integrity in yourself?
Well, I mean, you're gonna want integrity no matter what you do.
That's right.
Don't ever leave integrity at the door, because people are going to take you for who you are.
That's right.
And if you are not your authentic self,
that's it.
If you are not being the person that you know you are, you're trying to accommodate. I can't accommodate him because that's what he wants. I got to be a leader. So you have to be your authentic self. So don't change that for anybody.
That's right.
Well, and I'll say this. And to that point, to her point, you know, get comfortable with the fact that not everybody's your customer.
That's right.
That's the word.
The goal is not to sell something to everybody.
That's right.
You know, the goal is to know who your customer is and provide a superior experience for that customer. You know, it's funny, I coach and mentor at the New Venture Accelerator here at Auburn, and I was working with Grandma Val in Opelika, the sweet tea, the lemonade. And they came to me and brought me in on a working group and said, you know, she wants to expand. She wants to start packaging her lemonade. And she needs to know more about pasteurization and large scale manufacturing and bottling operations. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll jump in there. And so I came in the room and I said, Grandma Val, my first question to you is why?
That's right.
Why would you want to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to go jump out into an absolute battlefield with companies like Coca-Cola and Minute Maid and Pepsi that are making lemonade and selling it for 89 cents a bottle.
That's right.
And she said, well, Jason, I run out. I run out of product every day. And I can't make it fast enough, so I want to grow and try to expand. And I said, Grandma Val, why do you think that you run out? She said, I don't know, but I make 200 gallons a day and I have 50 people standing outside my business every day. Mm. I said, well, as an entrepreneur, and it took me a lot of years and millions of dollars to learn this lesson on the job. I said, you know what that means? You're not charging enough for your lemonade.
Mm.
Okay? Mm. So your price right now is $4.50. Tomorrow we're raising that price to $5. And there'll be 25 people standing outside your door. And the next day we're raising it to $5.50. And there'll be 10 people standing outside your door. And the next day we're raising it to $6. And there'll be 3 people standing outside your door. And that is price equilibrium. That is where you have discovered what your value actually is. I said, I don't want to hear you talk about expanding into Columbus or Phoenix City or anywhere else until you've sold a glass of lemonade to every person in Lee County, Alabama. Mm-hmm. You know, so just remember, not everybody's your customer. You don't have to go out and win the world over. 90% of the game is knowing who your customer is. And so
Jason said it nicely. I'm known for the other end. If you're not my customer, I really don't care what you think.
I mean,
I don't even care if you know I'm in business. If you're not my customer, and I guess the thing I would say to the economic development folk in the room, if you all would work really hard not to become so enamored with the big and the scale, focus on the small, the unique. Why? Because sometimes that's authentically who you are as a community. Authenticity is the biggest thing, whether it's business or economic development, especially if you're building community.
And boy, to that point, Grandma Val, y'all, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, you good, man.
Y'all,
good.
Listen, Grandma Val will pray for you when you buy a glass of lemonade from her. Do you understand how many miles people will travel off of an interstate?
That's right.
To have that kind of experience.
That's right.
You know, I mean, that's one anecdotal experience. But to Boyd's point, that's all we got here, especially in Alabama, in rural communities. People don't come to your community to eat at Applebee's. No offense to Applebee's. The world would not exist without franchise restaurant concepts. But it's not about landing this huge, massive deal. It's about finding those unique people in your community.
That's right.
And surrounding them with resources to allow them to be successful. And that one unique person in your community is what's going to get people to drive off the interstate 50 miles to come and hang out in your place for a weekend.
That's right.
Let me give Aaliyah just 30 seconds to kind of wrap up.
It would only be fair. I feel like.
So Aaliyah, any closing thoughts?
Give me the mic.
Yeah, thank you.
I would say, let me just say this. One question that I wanted to make sure that I kind of mentioned was, it asked, what would community development, what could you do for entrepreneurs? Guys, he said it best, it's quality over quantity. I know you have to meet numbers.
That's right.
And I know, but when you take your time and engage a small business, meaning, I tell people that want to know, Aaliyah, come to my business. Come and see what it is I do. Walk around this warehouse. Get to know me. Because the only way that you can assist them is to know them. You can't ask them what they want if you don't have the capacity to give it. You have to be able to understand the inner workings. And I know you work with multiple small businesses, but you may not be able to help all of them. Pick and choose those companies that you say, you know what? I see this. I can actually promote this. I know how to pitch this to somebody else. Talk to them about joint ventures. You may have several companies within your group that you can say, have y'all thought about working together? But you gotta communicate, and you gotta make sure you know these companies. You can't offer something that you don't have the capacity to give. If you're really good on the finance side, stick to that. If you're really good on the connecting side, stick to that. Make that your piece. So that's what I would have to say.
Join me in really just thanking this panel for a great session. Thank you.